Hello, 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 and welcome to the Ocean Mist Power Hour right here on KCIW 100.7 FM on your dial. Curry Coast Community Radio broadcasting from right here in Brookings Harbor, the gateway of the Great Pacific Northwest, about as far as you can get west in the continental U.S. Brookings, Oregon, home of daffodils in December, flowers all year round, and the nicest people you'll ever meet. Where the mountains and the redwoods meet the sea, Brookings Harbor is home to me. So who am I and why am I coming to you on this gorgeous, bright, beautiful day? Well, my name is Misty Young and I'm your hostess of the Ocean Mist Power Hour. This little fun, supreme selection of everyday deliciousness in language and exploration in all kinds of topics. From science to nutrition to fitness and yoga and singing and meditation and drag racing. Yes, I'm a motorhead too. I love all these things, biology and history and so much more. Now, before we open this show, which we're going to open with a fascinating story, an absolutely tragic and fascinating story of regional importance that I'm willing to bet most of our esteemed listeners have never even heard of. And yet this story is critical to the background and the history of our little fishing village right here on the Oregon coast. But in the meantime, let me tell you a little bit about Misty Young. Well, I'm from Southern California originally, born and raised there, and by way of Reno, Nevada for 30 years or so, and Truckee, California, the place in the country that often has the lowest temperatures in the whole nation, oftentimes single digits. Lived in Truckee for a long time and opened a little restaurant there. You might have heard of it. It's called Squeeze In. Tiny little place, 10 feet 3 inches wide, 62 feet deep, 12 tables. This little tiny place serves tens of thousands of guests every single year, and we're known for the best omelets on the planet. But that's not the big news. There is no big news. I'm just a regular old person who's done a lot of fun things in the course of life. So here we are now. By way of Reno, by way of Truckee, by way of Florida, this is a cool story. I'm going to tell it to you real short. We had this marketing firm, and it was a really big client, and the client was in Florida. And I decided on a whim, I think I need to move to Florida to help run this account. Picked up everything, moved to Florida, got off the plane, and got sick immediately, very sick with asthma. And I thought the asthma was related to pollens and dust. And I got real sick there and within 14 days decided I was leaving Florida. I said to my husband, I just can't stay here. There's no way. And I had had an opportunity to be in paradise, the most beautiful place in the world ever that I had ever been many years ago right here in Brookings, Oregon. And so sick as a dog in Florida, after literally selling half my possessions and moving across the country, 14 days in, I said, I'm out of here. I picked up Zillow. I started scrolling left and right, up and down, inside out, east, west, north, south, and I found a house in Brookings, Oregon that I had not seen in person before I called the agent and said, I want to buy it. She said, dude, you haven't even seen it. I said, dude, it doesn't matter. Put an offer in. I want that house. 2 days later, offer accepted. And 87 days after moving to Florida, we landed right here in Brookings, the most amazing place in the world. I mean, are we not blessed or what? Look at this little town. It's gorgeous. It's fantastic. We've got the outdoors. We've got the indoors. We've got the ocean. We've got the air. We've got birds. We've got birds. They're so wonderful. And we've got each other. We have this little, tiny, small town community feel. And KCIW is part of that. As you know, Curry Coast Community Radio helps bring people together in a way that says, what are you interested in? Let's hear about it. What do you want to learn about it? Let's learn about it. What do you want to find out about your world? Well, let's explore it. And that's what I intend to do with the Ocean Mist Power Hour. Again, there's going to be a lot of different topics. Everything from spirituality and nutrition. Nutrition particularly is a giant, giant interest of mine. I cannot wait to share what I've learned in nutrition with you. And have you share back at some point too. We're going to incorporate engagement in our Facebook page. We're going to post photographs and graphs and charts and images and links and backgrounds and all kinds of things that you'll be able to take your exploration further. Because this show isn't about me, it's about you. It's about our listeners. It's about our community. It's about coming together to learn more about each other, to build a community of people that are interested and interesting at the same time. But notice what came first. Interested. Interested. We have to be interested in each other first before we can be interesting with and to each other. So that's all I'm going to tell you about Misty Young today, your host of the Ocean Mist Power Hour again, right here on KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio 100.7 on your FM dial. Let's make this a regular conversation. Let's get together on a regular basis. Let's talk and learn from each other, and let's find out how far we can take this conversation. How deep can we go? How much more can we learn from each other? Well, I'm going to share with you now an incredible story, an amazing story of triumph and tragedy. I'm going to actually read the story to you, and I'm going to encourage you, after you hear this story, to get your own copy of this tiny little book. It's just 28 pages, a tiny little thing, but it is jam-packed with emotion and tragedy and triumph and courage and difficulty. So grab your tissues, really and truly, grab your tissues. And here's mine, right here. Did you hear that? They're right there in the background. I'm going to need them, because I've read this story several times, many times. And I can't help myself when I read this story. It moves me every single time. Now, I filled a little airtime there so you would go grab your tissues. You might grab a cup of tea, too, and settle in. And take us a few minutes to read this story. And if you're ready now, here we go. There Were No Birds, a memoir of the storm of 1972, Brookings, Oregon, by Jane Gibney. Special thanks in this story to the Brookings Harbor Commercial Fishermen's Wives Association, the Curry Coastal Pilot, the design and printing by Dave and Rob Lavelle and First Impressions, and Every Word Counts, right here in Brookings, Oregon. Proceeds from the sale of There Were No Birds benefit the Brookings Harbor Commercial Fishermen's Wives Association in support of its programs to help area fishing families. If you're ready, I'm ready. Here we go. Chapter 1. The Start of the Day. It was drizzling rain as the sun began to lighten the sky beyond the hills that ringed the town of Brookings. One by one, the pickups and cars pulled into the parking lot at the Sport Haven restaurant at the port. A few hundred yards away, the fishing boats swung against their cables at their moorage slips in the boat basin. It was coffee time for the fishermen, a time to talk of the day's activities and to discuss the weather. It would be a wet day, with slate-gray skies blanketing the area. Sport Haven was the gathering place for the men, as it was located close to their boats. The fishermen would stop there to have coffee or possibly some breakfast before it was time for them to board their boats and head out to sea. It was salmon season. The day was August 16th, 1972. "Morning," Butch said as he entered the counter area of the restaurant and sat down beside Jerry. "Wet today." "Morning, Butch," replied Jerry. "You're up early." Butch ordered coffee and then said, "Gotta make a dime." A young boy of 10 years took the seat next to Butch. It was his son, John. A few minutes later, a 17-year-old youth came in and sat beside the boy. This was Joel, John's cousin. They talked quietly while the older men sipped their coffee. John and Joel were going out on the boat that day with Butch. The boat was the Donna N, a 34-foot commercial fishing trawler. The boys were looking forward to a day of salmon fishing. "What do you think of the weather?" Butch asked Jerry. "Well," he replied, "it might blow. The barometer seems to be dropping a little. It's not raining hard, just misting. It looks pretty dark to the south, though." Jerry's boat was the Sea Breeze. She was slightly larger than Butch's boat. Jerry would be fishing alone that day. "Well, better get going. See you outside, Butch." "I'll be right behind you," Butch replied. More fishermen had come into Sport Haven, and some had left. It was a normal morning, with the usual early morning activity. There was no indication that this day would be any different from hundreds of other days at the Port of Brookings. Sport boats were being launched at the two large ramps. Some, moored in slips nearby, were gradually moving out and heading down the channel towards the breakwater. The commercial boats that were leaving were dodging the small craft and threading their way in the same direction. It was still quite dark, although the sky was lightening up towards the hills to the east of the port. Lights showed through the wheelhouse windows of other boats still in their slips. Towards the jetties, the white mast lights and the red and green running lights on those boats that were already headed out shone through the growing dawn. No flags flew at the Chetco River Coast Guard station, which was near the jetties. The boats, both large and small, continued past the station and on out to sea. No storm warnings of any kind were being displayed, no indication that anything might be wrong. Just a normal day, although it was still misting and the skies were dark. To the south, some 26 miles away, the next port had similar activity. At Crescent City, California, the boats were leaving and heading to sea just as they were at Brookings. No storm warning flags were flying from the staff at that harbor either. The sportsmen and the pleasure craft headed outside to fish around St. George Reef just offshore. Commercial vessels were in various stages of departure, and the harbor was serene and normal under a damp rain that filtered down from the dark clouds. There were no indications in Crescent City that it was not a normal August day except for the mist. About 26 miles to the north of Brookings at the port of Gold Beach, Oregon, there was little activity. There were a few fishermen going out that day. Some were already out and had been anchored along the beach the night before. If the weather had not been good, they would not have been able to anchor out there. Some of the boats fishing at Gold Beach were Brookings boats. They had been trolling for salmon just north of the Rogue River for several days. Everything was normal around there on the morning of the 16th, just as it was on all of the southern Oregon and northern California coasts. There was no Coast Guard station at Gold Beach, so I am not sure just how or where the warning flags were posted there. I presume there was a flagstaff at the boat basin or perhaps at the jetties. There were no flags flying there at that morning either. I got up around 6 a.m. My husband, Mike, was a commercial fisherman. He was fishing for albacore and was with the offshore fleet in the Coos Bay, Oregon area. The first thing I did that morning when I got up was to look at our barometer. It was very low, and I was surprised that it had dropped so much during the night. I gave it a tap, and it was still falling fast. The bottom had fallen out of it. I reached over and turned up the volume of the CB radio. Like some of the fishermen's wives, I left mine on all night, but with the volume turned down. Some leave theirs on low so that they can hear it. Some turn theirs off. Nearly all of the wives had those radios. The CB radios allowed the fishermen to talk to their homes as well as to the fish plants where they sold their catches. In many cases, they had CBs in their cars or pickups ashore, which they would use a great deal. It was the main communication between the boats and the beach. The larger boats had ship-to-shore radios, double sidebands, as well as the CBs. Nearly all of the boats carried CBs, including the little sport boats, skiffs, and the pleasure craft. Some of the weekend sportsmen carried walkie-talkie radios, which were the same frequencies as the CBs. The little boats, as a rule, really had no room for the larger double sideband radios. Early on the morning of the 16th, I heard the voices of our local salmon fleet. They weren't too concerned with the weather. It was drizzling, and the sky was gray, but it was August and time for the rains to start. Some skippers were talking about the low barometer, and there was a concern about it. They said that of all the weather reports they had heard, which weren't many, said nothing odd was happening. I turned on my AM radio and picked up the local broadcast station, KURY. They were giving a 5 to 15 mile per hour variable wind report. That was good weather. Their weather reports came from Eugene or Medford, Oregon, not from California. These reports may even have come from Portland. The Brookings boats monitored Channel 8 on the CB. That was the channel that the commercial boats used, and it was the one that I had tuned in. The sportsmen and party boats monitored Channel 11. To the south in Crescent City, the base stations on the beach and the boats monitored Channel 4. By switching channels during the day, the fishermen could find out the fishing conditions in both areas. They could also find out how the weather was down toward Crescent City. KURY Radio went on the air at sunrise, as it had a daylight to dark license only. The official weather reports that they gave came at the end of the newscasts on the hour. That morning, the 16th, they had given at least one report, and maybe two by the time I turned on my broadcast band and could catch the latest report. It was 4, 5 to 15 variable winds with no warnings. I was sure that was the report the fishermen were depending on and had mentioned before they went fishing. Occasionally during the morning, the fishermen talking on the CB would mention that the barometer was still falling. At 7 a.m., one of the skippers mentioned it again. Talk began about it being a short day and that they'd probably be going in early. Still, there was no talk of wind or seas building or anything to indicate a problem. It was no different from any other rainy morning when southerly weather was obviously in store. I was very worried, though. It was mid-August. Around the 20th or 21st of September would be the equinox. I had fished with Mike for 8 years on our boat, the Olean, and had been through many terrible equinox storms. I was afraid of equinox time. I would always dread that time of year after the experiences I had. The equinox storms could come as early as August and as late as October. The Columbus Day storm was one of those. I knew that the falling barometer, as low as I had ever seen it, meant that an early equinox storm was approaching. The drizzling rain indicated that the rainy season was starting. Equinox storms usually came with little or no warning and could build from dead calm to 100-knot winds in only a couple of hours. They were the North Coast's killer storms. No one even bothered to count how many boats left Brookings that morning. Sometimes the Coast Guard counted, but that was not always accurate because of the volume of vessels that crossed the bar during the summer months. On this day, there was no fog, no wind to speak of, and the weather report was good. The Chetco River Station was not flying any warning flags, and their reports must have been for good weather also. There was no real reason to keep track of how many vessels put out to sea that day. It would never be known exactly how many boats went out on August 16, 1972, from Brookings, Gold Beach, and Crescent City. Chapter 2: The First Warnings. On August 16th, time was of little importance. Later, it was determined that no one even thought of what time each event occurred. Fishermen did not remember exactly when they were in the restaurant, when they left their moorages, when they started to fish, or when they talked to each other on the radio. On the beach, it was the same. The wives did not remember when they got up, when they turned on their radios, or when they heard the various boats talking on those radios. It was such a quiet, normal morning that time meant little. It was simply just another day. About 7 a.m. or so, a fisherman radioed from his home that he had reports on his ship-to-shore receiver of wind to the south and building fast. He was calling on the CB to the boats outside. This man was Jim on the Mabel Jean. He was calling on Channel 8, and I heard him. Jim said that he had heard a tuna, albacore boat, offshore with 80-mile-per-hour winds. Then someone else came on, a fish processor on the beach, I think, that said that the draggers on Channel 6 on the CB below Crescent City had 86-mile-per-hour winds. Our little boats debated on the weather, but, as a whole, ignored those reports. "I heard it's southerly," Jim on the Mabel Jean insisted. "You'd better keep an eye out. The barometer is really dropping now. I think we got a storm coming." This was the first warning I had heard from anyone. It was an echo of my own thoughts and feelings. I knew Jim was absolutely right. He was trying to warn the fishermen who were not as experienced. "It looks okay," answered the skipper that Jim was talking to. "So far, no wind. We're not very far out anyway. We'll be in quick if it starts to blow." "Can you pick me up, Butch?" called a boat from the north. He was calling to Butch on the Donna N. "Go ahead, Bill," Butch answered. "Where are you?" "Oh, I'm heading home," Bill answered. It was Bill on the Manatee who had been fishing above Gold Beach. "I'm below Gold Beach, coming down. Call my wife for me, will you, Butch? She can't hear me from here. Tell her I'll be in a few hours. I'll need transportation.
Will do, Butch called back. How is the fishing up there, Bill?
Not too good, Bill said. He had been gone for several days and was anxious to be getting home.
What kind of weather do you have there?
I couldn't hear what Jim said.
We've got just a light air from the south now, Butch told him. Nothing to worry about, but the barometer is dropping. Jim said that he heard they have a strong southerly below us, but I didn't get how far down.
That's odd, Bill said. We have northerly up here. Strange.
We've got quite a little wind here. It's been blowing northerly since I left Rogue River Reef. Light rain, too. It should be blowing from the south here, too.
Well, Butch replied, keep in contact. If it looks any worse here, we'll let you know. Maybe you better go back to Gold Beach.
Right. See you later.
With that, Bill signed off, and the air was quiet for a moment. During the next hour or so, Jim called to the boats a few more times. He gave them weather reports that he was picking up on his other radio receiver. It sounded as though it was getting quite windy to the south. The men continued to fish, and the chatter on the CB was just the same as any other day.
Pick me up, Jerry, came the voice of Skip, one of the three fish buyers in Brookings.
Come back, Jerry.
You bet I do, Skip, Jerry on the sea breeze answered. Go ahead. Got a good report for us?
The weather is building a little now. A lump is coming up. Must have a wind offshore.
That's what I want to tell you, Skip said. I just got a call from some drag boats on Channel 6. They have 56 knot winds already, just below Crescent City. You guys better come in. It's moving up.
Thanks on that, Skip, Jerry answered. The wind seems to be coming faster now.
Butch, on the Donna N, called to Bill, who was still running down towards Brookings.
You better turn back, Bill. By the time you get here, it will be bad. We're getting a sea now, and it's coming fast.
Later, no one could remember the time this warning went out. It might have been 9 a.m. or a little earlier. Some said that it was a little later. Of all the fishermen at sea and the people monitoring the radios on the beach, there was not one who could remember what time each thing happened. Within the next hour, the boats began pulling in their salmon gear and turning the bows of their vessels towards home. To the south, just below Crescent City, the wind was a howling gale. On Channel 4, the men were talking of having trouble making headway against it. On Channel 8, at Brookings, the voice activity increased as the wind velocity picked up. The fishermen were calling to each other until it was hard to pick out any one in particular. It turned out later that those who made it into port with no difficulty were the ones that began heading home when Jim on the Mabel Jean put out his very first warning. Others, who stayed out to catch one more fish, found themselves in big trouble. The inexperienced men, the weekenders, did not understand the sudden worry over weather conditions, nor could they read the weather. They were the ones that would be needing help. All of the fishermen's wives listening in their homes turned their radio volumes up, and they stood by in case help might be needed. The Coast Guard did not monitor the CB radio. The radio is a type meant for the people, not the military, and by federal law, the government could not use them. So if anyone had only a CB on their boat and needed Coast Guard assistance, the call would have to go to the base stations on the beach. Those people with the base stations would call the local Coast Guard station on the telephone and alert them that way. Also, at 9 a.m., KURY radio station was still giving a 5 to 15 variable wind report. The boats, by then, were getting wind and beginning to have difficulty. It was nearly time for the 10 a.m. newscast. I called the radio station and asked Charlie, their announcer, to check his weather report because the boats were in bad trouble. He said that he could see the white caps from the window and the trees were swaying around the station. Then Charlie came on the radio and announced that a revised weather report was coming over the teletype from Eugene and to stand by. He said that all boats should use extreme care. There seemed to be a storm coming or something to that effect. Before Charlie could get the complete revised weather report on the radio, a tree fell, knocking the station off the air, and most of the downtown area electricity went out. So, even if a report had gotten to Brookings, no one would have heard it anyway.
Luckily, the power stayed on in other areas, and most of us with CBs were able to use them. By then, the boats were hitting the beach and capsizing. The times I put down that I called the radio station may be off as to an hour or a half hour. My records and the times later given at the inquiry were a little different. It was because during the storm we did not think about the importance of hour-by-hour information. About 10 a.m., the first Mayday call came in on the CB. Chapter 3. The Distress Calls. The first call for help came from a small boat in the Crescent City area. At least one telephone call was made from a fisherman's wife to the Chetco River Coast Guard Station as the Mayday message came over the CB. The 44-foot lifeboat was sent immediately to the area off St. George Reef where the Mayday call had originated. It was from the Allegra, with four people aboard. The Coast Guard cutter, Cape Carter, stationed at Crescent City, had been on offshore patrol and was not in the area. The station at Brookings was covering the Crescent City area. This was normal during the patrol duty of the Cape Carter. It meant cutting down on lifeboats and personnel at Chetco River Station, but it was standard Coast Guard practice. It had been that way for a time. Chetco River also sent a unit to Gold Beach during the summer to stand by there, which further lessened the available units for the Brookings area. The cutter was notified by radio, and the chief immediately headed for his normal search and rescue area. It would be some time before he would be able to reach the scene. It was all up to Chetco River. By the time the lifeboat from Chetco River reached the stricken vessel off St. George Reef, more distress calls were coming in over the radio from the Brookings area. All lifeboats were sent out, and all personnel available went to sea for rescue duty. All that was left at the station was one man to handle the incoming phone calls and to operate the radios. He had to direct the boats at sea and determine the locations of stricken vessels. He was only alone for a short period of time, but that young man did a great job of maintaining the efficiency and control at the station under very difficult circumstances. Actually, it was bedlam. The winds picked up in velocity within that hour and were gusting at 75 knots. There were no warning flags flying from the Coast Guard station, even yet, probably because there was no one available to raise them. The local radio station was off the air as a result of the power failure. The lifeboat that was sent to St. George Reef found the Allegra, took the four people off, and was towing the boat toward Brookings. The four were safe aboard the lifeboat. It was not very long before the tow had to be cut and the Allegra let go so the guardsmen could race back towards Brookings to assist more boats that were in trouble. From this time on, everything became chaotic. The time that the events took place and the boat names became confused. The power failure hit the Chetco River station, and it was without power until its emergency generator kicked in. Later, the station would not know just when many of the Mayday calls actually came in. All three channels on the CB radio were filled with Mayday calls. Channel 9, the normal distress channel for the CBs, was also carrying calls from boats in distress, but not nearly as many as on the regular channels that the boats used. The people on the boats did not even have time to switch to the distress channel. Some of the boats were sinking. Some simply called for help and nothing more was heard from them. The seas built so fast that no one on the boats could tell where they were or see vessels that were actually right beside them. Spray kicked up by the violent winds obscured visibility and rescue efforts were an impossibility. It had started to rain hard, and the wind was driving the rain in horizontal sheets. The boats could not see each other, and they could not see land. They were fighting for their lives. Many boats were unable to make headway against the wind. Others could not turn around without capsizing. As I listened on my radio, I was also in contact by phone with other fishermen's wives. We would call the Coast Guard station if we got a boat name or if it was a boat that we knew and we recognized the skipper's voice. We only knew the men on the commercial boats, not the sport boats. The man at the station would radio to the lifeboats. We got very few locations as the boats in dire need of help simply did not know where they were at all. If a sport boat gave us his name or location, we called those in too, of course.
One woman kept pleading with someone to help them. "Can't you see us?" she would cry. "Please help us. We're sinking."
We realized her boat was right near the buoy, just outside of the breakwater, and it was a little sport boat. There was no one to help her. The lifeboats were all outside of that buoy, fighting to save the people that would have no chance should they lose their boats. At least at the buoy, people on a boat might have made it to shore, or they could have run their boat up on the beach by the jetties. On another channel, another woman was pleading for help. She said that there were 5 people on their boat. They were sinking. She gave the name of the vessel. It was the Karen I. Boats off Crescent City, using Channel 4, were calling for help, and all available rescue units were at sea, unable to reach each boat that was yelling "Mayday" over the radio. There were just too many in distress, and all at one time. It was a complete madhouse. A friend of mine, Jill, daughter of Jerry on the Sea Breeze, came to the door. She was married to a fisherman, Brian. He wasn't out fishing that day. She stood in the doorway, listening to the radio. Behind her, the wind was blowing sheets of water straight across towards the north. The wind was rippling the roof of our mobile home. It was howling in the fir trees around us. Then a voice came in over the sounds of others in trouble. It was a voice that I knew very well. He said, "I can't keep up with it. I'm sinking." That was all that we heard him say. Jill turned pale and said very softly, "That was Butch, wasn't it?" I told her it was. It was Butch on the Donna N. Later, as far as anyone could find out, Jill and I were the only ones to hear that Mayday call and to recognize Butch's voice. We both knew him very well. He was not heard from again.
"There's a boat on the rocks," came an unidentified voice. It was a few minutes before the location could be pinpointed. The 144-foot lifeboat with officer in charge Don and one crewman aboard headed into the surf to try to rescue the fishermen. They knew that they would have to put the lifeboat on the beach if they were unable to turn around in the giant, foaming breakers. They went in without hesitation. The spray covered the lifeboat as well as the fishing boat, already breaking to pieces in the pounding waves. Somehow, the Coast Guardsman got Doyle, the fisherman, off and pulled him aboard the tossing lifeboat. With strength from an unknown source, Chief Don turned the lifeboat and somehow brought it out of the breakers and into deep water. Doyle was safe, but his boat, the Krista, was lost close to the North Jetty. He had almost made it into the harbor. Almost. A drag boat, the Pam Bay, running down the coast from the north, found the wreckage of the Dixie Lee. He pulled a young man, David, from the spray-tossed ocean. David was alive. His grandfather, Clayton, was floating face down in the water, his life jacket still in place. A Coast Guard lifeboat took his body aboard. One fatality from the Dixie Lee that we knew for certain and had heard about on the radio. "Help us! We're east of the buoy!" came a frantic call from a woman. A man's voice could be heard in the background. Then at least 2 people were on the boat being swamped at the buoy. They were nearly within reach of the safety of the harbor. We couldn't get any more information from the woman. She was not listening. She was just screaming, "Help!" Jill couldn't stand it any longer. All of this had happened in just the few minutes that she had been standing in the doorway. Her father was out there. I told her that I had heard him on earlier and that I thought he had run for home before all of this got bad. I thought that Jerry had listened to Jim's warnings from the Mabel Jean and had headed for port. "I have to go," Jill said. "I can't help anymore. I'm going to cry. See you later." Jill left. I learned later that Jill went down to the harbor to the lounge at Sport Haven. They said that she came in and stood by the door, looking very white and very unsteady. "Butch is dead," she said. The people in the bar, some of whom were fishermen and the bartender, could not believe what she had just said. They asked her to repeat it. "I just heard it on Jane's radio. Butch is dead. The Donna N is gone," she repeated. "Some other people are dead too."
It was the first time that the people in the bar realized just how bad the storm really was. It was not yet 11 a.m. The seas, pushed by gale-force southerly winds, had made the entrance to the harbor impassable. Breakers covered the bar area of the channel. No boat could cross without capsizing or hitting the rocks of the jetties. Those still out would have to stay out, and no more vessels could go out to help those who did not make it in, except the motor lifeboats of the Coast Guard. They were built to roll over in the breakers and were self-righting. The party boats would have to protect their passengers and ride out the winds as best they could. They could only hope that no one would panic. Those were the passenger boats, the ones that took people out for hire. There were 13 passengers on the Lita J that day alone. Fred, the skipper of the Lita J, was an experienced party boat owner and would bring his party in safely. The small boats would have to keep the water out of them by any means possible. Calls of skiffs being found upside down did not help the situation. Some of them may have broken loose from the larger boats. Some panic occurred. Although nearly all of the men and women at sea during the hours of violent wind stayed reasonably calm, some did not. The sound of crying, pleas for help, and screams coming over the radio that day was something that I would remember all the rest of my life. The growing reality of the size of the disaster and the fear for the lives in jeopardy made heroes of many that day. There were a great many individual stories of people who helped those around them, acting quickly and without thought for their own safety. Chapter 4. Those Who Helped. When the first distress calls came over the radio, phone lines were cleared, as most people in this small rural community had party lines. So many calls went into the Coast Guard station that the phone rang busy continuously. I had to clear my party line too. My neighbors were glad to help by keeping the line open. With the phone line at the station ringing busy, we decided that we had to do something about it. Peggy, a fisherman's wife, had a CB unit in her pickup. She drove down to the harbor and out to the Chetco River station. She parked as close to the front door as she could get. That opened up our lines of communication. Peggy monitored from there. She sat in her truck, and when we would call her and give her what information we had over the CB, she would run through the door and give the information to the radio operator. Sometimes she heard a call that we were hearing, and that would be put out of the truck before we could even call her. The radio man would then put the data out to the lifeboats over his radio. Peggy also directed shore parties with radio units to where they were needed. The Krista and the D&D had both hit the beach, the Krista by the north jetty and the D&D near the south. The Brookings Police Station, where a CB radio had just been recently installed by the Citizens Band Radio Club in the area, was equally busy taking down what information they could gather. So many calls were going to them, their phone was also ringing busy. People with radio units in their vehicles gathered at the breakwater, forming lines, lifelines when needed, and others raced to the beaches to the south and north of town. Search parties were organized, and even before the winds had subsided, hundreds of people were already walking the wet, stormy sand looking for survivors, wreckage, or whatever they could find that might help. Coffee was available at the Coast Guard station supplied by the guardsmen's wives who went to the station to assist wherever and however they could. A plea went out for blankets and towels. Peggy put that out on the CB. The people who heard it rushed the needed supplies to the station. As the survivors were brought in by the Coast Guard and other rescue vessels, they had swamped the station and depleted their blanket supply. By 11 a.m., the winds began to subside. The radio channels quieted down, but the horror was just beginning to unfold. In 2 hours, the Crescent City, Brookings area had lost numerous boats and an unknown number of lives. Those of us with radios knew nearly right away that at least 4 people were lost, perhaps 9, if the Karen I was gone with 5 people. Personnel from the larger Coast Guard station to the north were sent to Brookings to assist. Larger beach parties were organized and sent out. Aircraft were sent into the air over the area. There were helicopters and fixed-wing planes. Coast Guard cutters were sent from all major West Coast ports to aid in the search. It was some time before they all reached Brookings. It was too late to help those already missing. Too late to pull survivors from the surf. That had already been done. No more boats were lost after 11 a.m. No more Maydays were heard. And no more people died. Many of the boats that had radioed in Mayday calls reached their harbors safely, both in Brookings and in Crescent City. The small boat that had been east of the buoy and sinking reached its mooring safely in Brookings after 4 p.m. That was when the bar stopped breaking and the boats were able to go in and out freely once again. Jim, on the Mabel Jean, the fisherman who had radioed the first storm warning, had raced to the boat basin. He had cast off the lines of his 50-foot fishing boat. The bar was starting to break, but he took the boat out to sea to help where he could. He saved many skiffs on the bar by turning his large boat sideways against the raging wind and creating a lee for them. The skiffs were being turned over by the force of the gale, and Jim ran beside some of them until they were safely between the jetties, and then he turned back and went out to try to bring in some others. Later in the afternoon, when the storm was past, Jim went offshore and searched until dark. He looked for those who had called for help but had not returned safely to port. He hunted for Butch on the Donna N and the two boys. He looked for the Friend family on the Karen I. The winds had downed trees in town, and the Brookings radio station had been off the air since the first strong gusts of wind had raked the area. No news could be given to the people. And it was only those of us with CBs that were fully aware of the tragedy of that day, August 16. Everyone who had a CB in their home was flooded with telephone calls. Families, friends, and people from all over the West Coast called to find out what had happened to Brookings and how bad it was. It made the big news networks on television and radio before Brookings itself could get its own radio station back on the air. No one in Brookings knew right away just how terrible it was, and we had to tell the people who called just that. We didn't know, but it was very bad. It was during the very height of the storm and at the time of most of the Mayday calls that my phone rang. It was a television station in Medford, Oregon. They wanted to know what was wrong in Brookings. I did not realize at the time that the call was being broadcast live over TV. They could not reach the police, the Coast Guard, the sheriff's office, or the radio station. All of the lines rang busy, and they had to find out what was going on. Someone that they did reach finally told them to call me, that I would know. I am sure that the television people could hear my CB in the background as the volume was turned up. People were screaming, and some of them were yelling, "Mayday!" I told the caller that we had been hit by a sudden southeaster that came without warning. I told them that the power was out in most of Brookings. I also told them that we had lost a lot of boats and there were fishermen missing. I had to tell them that there were some known dead. They could hear my radio and tell that it was bad. I had no doubt of that. Then they started to ask more questions, things that I did not know the answers to, like how many were missing. I got very upset, even worse than I already was, and I only remember saying, "I have to go. People are dying here. They need my help." I hung up. I was told later by a friend who was in Medford at the time that she had heard something had cut Brookings off from the world. She had been really scared until she heard me on television. It had been the first communication from Brookings and the first she had heard from anyone that she knew since she had heard the first reports at about 10 a.m. that morning. Her family was all in Brookings. She was afraid something had happened to them. She finally knew that they were all right when I told her, the reporter, that it was a storm at sea. She knew that I would tell it like it was. She felt bad about the missing fishermen, but was relieved that her parents were safe. I never did hear that television report myself. I never even thought to turn on the TV. The fishermen's wives helped to coordinate rescues by gathering information from the CBs and calling me or Peggy at the Coast Guard station. Among them, more voices were recognized, more boat names were known to them, and it all contributed to more rescues. There were Iris, Tilly, and most of all, Evelyn, my next-door neighbor, whose husband, Bill, had the manatee. We reached Bill later in the day. He had returned safely to Gold Beach that morning. Chapter 5, The Afternoon. After about 11 a.m., the radios were quiet. Peggy stayed on the job until darkness fell. She radioed to the others all of the information that she could get from the Coast Guard station. As bodies were recovered, she would let the fishermen know. As wreckage was spotted, it would be put out on the CB. Bill, on the Manatee, finally called home to say that he had turned back and was safely in Gold Beach. It was the first indication for Evelyn that Bill was all right. She had gone through the entire storm, not hearing one word after his early morning conversation with Butch. She had stayed by her CB and had helped, but she was really worried. We had no way of knowing how far up the coast the storm had gone. Those with radios had already heard that Clayton, on the Dixie Lee, had lost his life, and that his grandson had been rescued. His wife had not known. We did not know if she had a CB and wasn't listening, or if she used a friend's radio, but as the winds subsided, we all heard her voice as she radioed, "Pick me up, Dixie Lee. Can you hear me, Clayton?" Those listening were silent. No one knew what to do or tell her. If she was told to go to the Coast Guard, the shock might be too much. The Coast Guard had been trying to reach her personally, so everyone remained quiet. Some of the fishermen's wives cried, while some just sat or stood in their homes in stunned silence. I cried. It had been the final blow. I just stood and cried. Three bodies had been recovered the first afternoon of the storm. The list of missing grew as boats failed to return to the harbors. The only calls on the radio that afternoon were from fishermen calling friends that they knew would never answer. The Coast Guard search was carried on over the ship-to-shore radio, and very little was said on the CB about that activity, as very little was known. Friends of those who were missing located relatives and made sure that the immediate families were not left alone that afternoon. Food was taken to their homes where possible, and calls were taken by friends so that the families would be spared at that time of grief. The entire town hoped that more people would be found alive, perhaps along the beaches. They formed many large search parties to walk the beaches. As darkness fell, hope faded. It was believed at first that perhaps as many as 20 people were missing. The Donna N., with Butch, his son John, and nephew Joel, did not return to port. The Karen I. was found capsized, and the bodies of the mother and one son were recovered. Clayton, on the Dixie Lee, had died, and his body was recovered. Those were the ones we knew about the first day. Three more people were missing from the Karen I, the father, another son, and a friend of the family. Several small boats from Crescent City were missing. The number of people aboard each of them was not known at that time. I do not know when the electricity went on in town, but it was sometime in the afternoon. Mine had been on all of the time. The radio station in Brookings went back on, finally, and the news of the disastrous storm was carried as reports came in. Not much was known. It had happened so fast, the shock had blanketed the entire area. Hundreds of people were involved in the beach searches. They kept looking out to sea as if they would see one of the missing boats drifting. But it never happened. Everyone was quiet, even in the stores and walking down the streets. There was nothing to say. Chapter 6. Aftermath. The sea and air searches continued for days. Two more bodies were found. One man from a small boat out of Crescent City was found floating off St. George Reef. That was the following day, August 17th. 2 days later, on August 19th, another body was recovered in the Crescent City area. As close as the Coast Guard could tell, 13 people were still missing. Shore parties continued to search the beaches. The debris that was found was brought to the Coast Guard station. So were the pieces of wreckage found at sea. Parts of the Donna N. were found, as were pieces of other missing boats. Some boats were lost without a trace. Both the Brookings and Crescent City communities went into mourning. Flags on county and city offices flew at half-staff, as did the large flag on the Elks Club building. Fishermen talked of what they had heard on the radios the day of the storm. They tried to remember as much of it as they could, No one could remember exactly when the various calls were made, nor could they say exactly when the wind reached its top velocity. They couldn't tell just when it began to subside. It all just started around 9 a.m. and was over at 11 a.m. That was all that anybody knew. Time had meant nothing during the storm. Time did mean something to the Coast Guard Board of Inquiry, which met 2 years later. It was set up to investigate the storm. Not one of those testifying could actually pinpoint a time for any single event. Testimony lasted for 2 days. There were a few things that I found out later that should be put down here, mainly for the record. The Tautog, a dragger, came upon the Karen I as he was heading for shelter. The skipper of the Tautog was a Crescent City fisherman who had been dragging north of Brookings. The Karen I was dead in the water and sinking. There were 5 people aboard, the friends. I heard their initial mayday call, that is noted earlier in this story. There were the mother, father, 2 sons, and a friend. The skipper pulled the Tautog up to the stern of the stricken vessel and told them to get aboard his boat. He and his crewmen would help them. They refused to leave their boat. They would not leave it out there with no one to watch out for it. They would not go with the Tautog. Afraid for his own crew and his own boat, the skipper backed the Tautog off and resumed his trip to port. All of the friend people were lost. I talked to Bill on the Manatee when he returned to Brookings from Gold Beach. He told me that the main reason he had turned back and gone into Gold Beach that morning was not so much because the other fishermen were telling him it was lumping up fast and that the wind was coming, but because as he came south, he didn't see any birds. Bill felt that he should have warned the others. I don't think they would have listened anyway. They didn't listen to Jim on the Mabel Jean or Skip, the fish dealer, or to anyone else. Bill said that the birds usually were flying overhead or floating lazily on the water whenever he ran down from Gold Beach to Brookings. There always seemed to be bait schools and food for them along that area, but this day there were no birds at all. Not one. At the time, Bill said that it felt ominous. He knew that the storm was coming, but the birds knew it first. He just turned back and went into Gold Beach. That's why I titled this story, There Were No Birds. Our fishermen never noticed that. Bill was an old-timer. He'd been a fisherman for many years. But then, so had Butch. There was some good from all of this. Not much, but some. It took a few years and a lot of lobbying by the fishermen's wives and me. But we got 2 things. We finally got the Coast Guard to monitor the CB. But they would only monitor Channel 9, the distress channel. And we got the weather station on Palmer Butte, up Gardner Ridge Road. It gives continual weather forecasts and a special one for the Crescent City, Brookings area. We have not had a killer equinox storm since that one, and we are long overdue. When it comes, and it will come, let's hope that everyone has learned something from the August 16th storm. It was an equinox southerly. Let's all hope. This memoir is dedicated to the men, women, and children caught in the tragic storm of August 16th, 1972, and the rescuers who worked so hard to bring them home. Lost at Sea, August 16th, 1972. Richard B. Butch Crook. John M. Crook. Joel M. Crook, Clayton Dooley, Joe F. Leone, Robert Wilson, Dennis Main, Matthew Main, Virginia M. Friend, William C. Friend, William C. Friend, Jr., Brian C. Friend, Donald C. Higgins. And a final poem. I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer by. From Sea Fever, by John Masefield. The end.
Well, thank you so much for being part of this inaugural Ocean Mist Power Hour story time. This is such an example of amazing courage and heroism, and it's so thrilling to have been able to share the book, There Were No Birds, with you. Of course, we've been reading the book, There Were No Birds, by Jane Gibney. It was published by Every Word Counts right here in Brookings, Oregon. It is available down at the harbor. So if you go down into the port, there's a visitor center there. You could talk to Barb Charmella there, and she will hook you up with a copy of this little booklet. What a just a precious book. The proceeds from the sale of There Were No Birds do benefit the Brookings Harbor Commercial Fishermen's Wives Association in support of its programs to help area fishing families. And finally, if you've tuned in to this inaugural episode of the Ocean Mist Power Hour right here on KCIW 100.7 FM on your FM dial, this is Curry Coast Community Radio, and we are broadcasting out of Brookings, Oregon. This is one of the most beautiful places in the world. I like to say Brookings Harbor is the gateway of the great Pacific Northwest. It's about as far west as you can get in the continental U.S. It's the home of daffodils in December, flowers all year round, and the nicest people you'll ever meet. This is where the mountains and the redwoods meet the sea. Harbor Brookings is home to me. And if it's home to you too, then find ways that you can get involved. Curry Coast Radio, right here on KCIW, is a great way for you to get involved. You can visit our website at kciw.org. Find a way to hook up with the stories, the authors, the hosts, the guests. There's a tremendous amount of information being shared right here on KCIW that can benefit you, your household, your friends, your family, your community. And really, isn't that what it's all about? We make the world a better place first by making ourselves better, and then by helping our family, and then by helping in our neighborhood and in our community, and then in our town, and then in our state, and then in our region, and then in the world. We really can make the world a much better place by starting with our own selves. And you can get more connected, and you can get more community-minded right here on Curry Coast Community Radio, KCIW 100.7 FM. Thanks for listening. I'm Misty Young, your host of the Ocean Mist Power Hour, and I look forward to seeing you again soon on the Ocean Mist Power Hour right here on KCIW.